This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. Disneyland, measles, conspiracy theories, vaccinations, and presidential politics. Here's Kentucky Senator and medical doctor Rand Paul on CNBC.
I've heard of many tragic cases of walking, talking, normal children who wound up with profound mental disorders after vaccines. I'm not arguing vaccines are a bad idea. I think they're a good thing. But I think the parents should have some input. The state doesn't own your children. Parents own the children, and it is an issue of freedom.
The idea that measles would return in unvaccinated populations because of a belief that vaccinations cause mental problems in children is a political issue once again. This 2015 argument about vaccination as a possible cause of autism and about government control over families was seeded by a 1998 study published in a very well-regarded journal by surgeon and medical researcher Andrew Wakefield. Despite the passions of hopeful parents, researchers who tried to replicate the study failed to find any link. Skepticism about Wakefield's claims mounted until a 2004 investigation by the Sunday Times of London found Wakefield had fabricated the entire study with a financial motive. And as we hear today, this did not end matters. Joining us is Brian Deere, an investigative journalist for the Sunday Times of London. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi there, John.
Do you think the Wakefield study is the parent of all the controversy that's going on right now in U.S. politics over the vaccination question?
I do, because what happened was it triggered the scare in the UK. The United Kingdom doesn't export much these days, a bit of pharmaceuticals, financial services, and a bit of defense equipment. But one of the things it has exported twice in recent decades has been scares over vaccines. Back in the 70s and 1980s, a scare was exported from London about the safety of the diphtheria tetanus pertussis vaccine, which turned out to be a complete red herring, although it triggered all kinds of problems in the United States. And then in 1998, the Wakefield paper appeared in The Lancet and essentially re-exported the same scare, but this time concerning the measles, mumps and rubella vaccine, MMR. So these scares can be traced back directly to the United Kingdom and to the particular circumstances, the legal circumstances, the media circumstances that exist here.
Is there something about the autism question that inflamed the way in which the Wakefield study was taken into popular discussion, in that parents were desperate to find out what was wrong with their children? Medical science didn't have much of an answer, and that in this particular case, it took on a life of its own, even greater than what might have been the case in the diphtheria experience a decade earlier.
These neurological issues that tragically emerge in children do emerge at the same historical period in their lives that they're being vaccinated. So when somebody comes along, a doctor comes along and says, you know, I think it could be the vaccine that causes autism, and autism, in as much as we understand it to exist as an entity, because it's a bit of a construct, in as much as it exists, medicine and science don't have answers for it. So you have a ready group of parents looking for answers. And what we had placed into the mix here in the United Kingdom was a massive publicly funded, taxpayer funded lawsuit that was going on behind the scenes that ultimately, at today's conversion rates and values, involved about $56 million being spent on trying to work up a case that the MMR vaccine caused autism. And we had an injection into that of this claim by Wakefield, who, in fact, we discovered was working for the lawsuit, claiming to have made prima facie evidence of a link between autism and vaccine.
Did Wakefield exploit these parents? Did he manufacture science? Did he distort existing science? How would you evaluate
it? Well, that would be what I say. The British General Medical Council, who took away his license to practice medicine, found him guilty of four counts of dishonesty involving his research, including a dishonest description of the children enrolled in it. And they also made a finding that his own lawyer described as fraud. Then the editor of The Lancet itself, back in 2010, withdrew his paper, calling it the most appalling catalogue and litany of some of the most terrible behaviour in any research. And then the British Medical Journal in 2011, its editors described Wakefield's work as elaborate fraud.
Why do you think there are people out there, even listening to this segment, who will take all of those arguments and go, well, that's the conspiracy?
Well, that's the nature of it. I mean, there are people who are out there doing that. And those people today, as I say, about the internet, we have this issue that people like that can find each other, just in the same way that people who believe that Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States, or who believe that the US government was responsible for the World Trade Center collapsing. There are people out there like that. But what you have in this particular case as well is you have a number of people who claim that the thing has been scientifically verified, when in fact it hasn't. So you're kind of in this position where anybody who comes along and tries to challenge these arguments gets accused of being involved in some dastardly conspiracy. I'm accused of being involved with the drug industry. I mean, Wakefield himself went on CNN and said that I was being supported by the Association of the British Pharmaceutical Industry, a body I've had no dealings with in like 25 years when I last asked them for a press release over something. So these kind of things take off, and you end up into that kind of conspiracy theory environment, and science so often goes out the window.
How do you explain the fact that Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who is a medical doctor, persists in this notion of normal children wound up with profound mental disorder after vaccines, as though that's a cause?
You know, without getting too political about it, I do think you find that on the conservative right, you find people who are inclined to want to take a pop at the government. Because when you think about it, vaccines, which everybody has, and which in the United States CDC speaks for the safety of, and FDA speaks for the safety of, these are arms of government, and there are politicians who want to take a pop at government. And it's interesting, I mean, perhaps Rand Paul is not an ideal example because he is a doctor, but I personally believe that the people who are most likely to shun vaccines are people who, for whom it is important to believe that they are smarter than doctors. And that's not a left-right thing. It's quite often quite an upscale thing. Certainly in the United Kingdom, we found that it was in the more affluent areas that vaccine rates declined. I mean, we saw tremendous measles outbreaks across the United Kingdom as a result of this vaccine scare. We saw ahead of the United States what you're seeing now. And indeed, we know that you will see much worse than what you're getting now. I mean, you ain't seen nothing yet when it comes to measles outbreaks in the United States.
Brian Deer, investigative journalist for the Sunday Times of London, who investigated the original case of the Wakefield study that was discredited, that described a harm in the use of vaccines in children and a supposed link to autism. Brian Deer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Members of the British Parliament have voted to approve a fertility technique that's still illegal here in the U.S. It's controversial because it creates babies that technically have the DNA of three different people, a mother, a father, and a female donor. But the donor only adds a little bit of mitochondria, which only accounts for about 0.01% of the baby's DNA. So it's not exactly a third parent, and it could be welcome news to thousands of people who have a family history of mitochondrial diseases. Dr. Jamie Griffo is program director of the New York University Fertility Center. He helped pioneer this technique nearly two decades ago. Dr. Griffo, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Is three parents a bit of an overstatement here when we think about this procedure and this technology?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really caustic way of presenting what's being done. This is a technique that's designed to help women who carry a mutation in their mitochondria from having a child who could be quite ill. There's not really three parents involved. The nuclear DNA comes from mom and dad. Mitochondria, which we all have and are highly conserved, are the problem. And there's donor mitochondria in this case. So that's where, you know, people have taken poetic license to call it a three-parent baby to make it sound like this horrible thing. And it's really not. It's designed to help people have healthy babies.
Well, even if it is three parents using different kinds of DNA, that's only horrible because we have this bias towards thinking about normal. I mean, fertility treatments have assisted families for decades in ways that we would have thought 100 years ago were monstrous, but things change, right?
Correct. And I think the way we think about it can change as well, although you know, these techniques are for patients who need them, people who have no understanding of the disease or the plight of these patients in their lives and how this impacts them can be very judgmental. And I would suggest practice empathy first. Try and understand why somebody would do this instead of judging them.
And someone who would, and you helped pioneer this technique, the person who benefited from this technique would know the three donors in theory, right?
Well, yes. I mean, the mom, it would be her nuclear DNA and the dad's nuclear DNA. And there would be a donor, usually it's an anonymous donor for the mitochondrial portion. So they don't really know the person per se, although they can if they choose.
So it's not anything like the parenting of a nuclear mom and a nuclear dad who get together with a sperm and an egg.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing. They talk about designer babies. I mean, since I did the first embryo biopsy in the United States in 1992, the question has always been, what about designer babies? What about designer babies? Well, now we're how many years later? And we still haven't had the designer babies that everybody's afraid of because we don't know how to do that. We're not trying to do that. But just because there's a fear of some misuse of technology doesn't mean we should stop it. It's something that's been available for a long time to help this group of patients, and it's been held up partly because of the way it's presented and understood and misunderstood, and partly because the regulators have kept it at bay. However, look, all new technology has risks. We take risks in everything we do every day, and who gets to decide risk-benefit ratios of techniques? And the problem is it's in the hands of people who don't truly understand the science or the medicine and the patient who needs it.
Dr. Jamie Griffo is program director of the NYU Fertility Center. Dr. Griffo, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We have some of you reacting to this. Templeton, California, who decides how far is too far or what a family should look like? Besides, there are times, as in this case, when this has real medical rationale. Salt Lake City, society seems to obsess far more over how a child is created as opposed to how a child is raised. Why is procreation so much more important or controversial than quality of life?
This is Ann Thompson from Portland, Oregon. My opinion is being pushed around by the press to create a controversy. A devastating genetic problem is being dealt with by using mitochondrial DNA of a third person. This is not the same as the creation of a human monster or chimera.
Join the conversation at 8778MYTAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
You might want to rethink lunch or dinner after this next story. The Obama administration wants to boost spending on food safety by $1.6 billion, with particular emphasis on getting food inspections to be the responsibility of a single government agency, instead of the current system where made in the USA means inspected by the FDA, USDA, FSIS, or CDC. By the way, if they find anything wrong, they can't compel a recall in most cases. The chaos that exists today means that in the U.S., we could publish a menu based solely on the presence of bacteria and contaminants. You like E. coli and salmonella? Go for the chicken parts, won't you? Not so much. Get the chicken breasts or whole chicken, perhaps a cantaloupe. If your taste runs to listeria, maybe choose pork, but don't buy steak, which is, for political reasons, E. coli-free. Will S. Hylton is the author of a terrifying New Yorker article titled A Bug in the System, Why Last Night's Chicken Made You Sick. And food safety lawyer Bill Marler is the man leading the charge against unsafe food in the Hylton story. Hylton and Marler, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Bill, let me just begin with you. What are the kinds of things that Americans are getting sick with from eating food that is ostensibly inspected?
Well, hamburger's better today than it was 20 years ago, you know, but what we're seeing is caramel apples just in the last month killing five people. I mean, caramel apples, for God's sakes. We had a listeria outbreak in 2011 in cantaloupe that killed 33 people, sickened 147. It was the largest foodborne illness death toll in the United States in 75 years. So there's a lot of things that are making us sick, and we have a government system that's frankly inept and broken. And I'm kind of pleased to see that the Obama administration, after all these years, is actually making an interesting move.
Will, what kinds of things have frightened you about the consequences of getting contaminated by food that seems just fine coming right off the shelf?
Well, some of these pathogens are getting worse, for one thing. I mean, they're developing an increasing level of drug resistance. So some of them are multi-drug resistant. And there's, for example, a strain of Salmonella that was in a huge outbreak at Foster Farms I looked at in the chicken, which is called Heidelberg. And this particular set of strains that were in the outbreak, we're sending about 40% of victims to the hospital. So that's a lot worse than Salmonella usually is.
And just give me the symptoms. I have to hear them. I have to share these symptoms with people.
Well, so one of the they're estimated to be about 18,000 victims. One of them is a guy named Rick Schiller, who's being represented by Bill. And Rick's symptoms were that he started feeling sick one day. A couple of days later, he woke up in the middle of the night, and his leg hurt, and he reached under the covers, and it was hard to the touch, and it was hot. And so he turned on the light and pulled the covers back, and he said his leg was about twice or three times the usual size and bright purple. And he went to the hospital, and the doctors told him that he had the Salmonella and that it was causing all sorts of inflammation and that there was a chance that his leg might burst. Now, they managed to get it under control to where it didn't burst, but he continues today to have extreme symptoms from the Salmonella. That happened in September of 2013. And there wasn't a recall of the contaminated chicken until July of 2014.
And you can go to Will's piece in The New Yorker and hear about how the leg was drained of this material that I just will so sicken you. It's just not even funny. And so, Bill, this is clearly, to the cynical, an ideal situation for a lawyer who wants to get big damages from jury verdicts. But would you say that your jury verdicts in your successful career as a lawyer here fighting these cases is the main sort of countervailing force that's encouraging the industry and government to reform?
You know, although I have a large ego, my ego is not that quite that large. I think I'm one aspect, but it's a pretty powerful aspect. I mean, when I get subpoena power, when I file a lawsuit, I can compel people to disclose information that is, otherwise secret. And shining the light on bad behavior in food companies is one of the great things that consumers can do in the civil justice system. You may not like lawyers. You may think, bad things about us. But the one great leveling thing that lawyers and consumers can do is when they take on a company, they can level the playing field and bring to light the kind of information that prompts change. And we've seen that change. It's slow. It's painful. It's nasty. And government can do way more. And I'm really pleased that, Will did the story, and primarily because it shows, what the government is still not doing.
Will, before we go, would you say that the industry wants to be better, but the government's chaos and the various agencies make it difficult for the industry to do that? Or is this mostly bad behavior?
I think it's really hard to say what industry wants to do. I think that, for example, in the case of Foster Farms, you have seen a lot of improvement since that outbreak. The government during that period was trying to get evidence that would allow them to request a recall of the Foster Farms chicken, and they weren't able to develop the very high evidentiary standard that they have to meet in order to request that recall. And absent that request from the government, there was no recall for over a year. So it seems that the problem is widespread. I think it's fair to say that the regulatory system is neither especially regulatory nor much of a system. And a lot of the people in it, whether in industry or in government, are very grateful to have Bill out there and have said that to me because they feel like he's one of the pieces in this system who can act independently and make judgments without being confined by the cumbersome bureaucracies that are everywhere else.
Well, the forces of change may be emboldened by $1.6 billion if that goes through the budget, and the idea that an inspection regime from the federal government would be under one agency in the Department of Health and Human Services. Will and Bill, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Bill Marler is an attorney fighting food safety cases, and Will Heilton is the author of a terrifying New Yorker article titled "A Bug in the System, Why Last Night's Chicken Made You Sick."
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
The current budget debate in Congress will be driven, as it always is, by the state of the economy, including the latest jobs numbers we will hear about on Friday. Those numbers are expected to be good, by the way. And one thing Republicans and Democrats agree on these days is that the economy is doing well. But a very loud debate is about to start in Washington, D.C., over whether the glass is half empty or half full, whether the economy is rocketing forward because of smart policies or being held back by misguided policies. And here to take us inside that important debate is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So who are the voices you've chosen here who really symbolize what's going to be going on in this debate?
Well, first, John, the Republicans, they have the reins of the House and the Senate. And I sat down with Congressman Kevin Brady. He's a 9-term Republican from Texas and a senior member of the powerful Ways and Means Committee. That committee controls trade and Medicare and taxes. And I asked Brady about income inequality because, you know, a lot of Republicans are acknowledging that that's a problem for the very first time. And Brady said, yeah, it's a problem, but...
The biggest problem facing families is not income inequality. It is that their paychecks simply aren't growing. You know, despite how hard they work, in some cases they've actually been shrinking since the financial recovery began. And I think that's the issue we should tackle. And I really think the solution is not a top-down, more regulation, higher taxes, more government programs. I think it's just the opposite. I think our local businesses want to hire.
So what do they want to do to take the brakes off in their view?
Well, John, Brady says the real problem is the purchasing power of the dollar. And in addition to getting rid of regulations and lowering taxes, as you might expect, he points a finger at the Fed. He says low interest rates have heated up Wall Street, and that's what's fueled the wealth at the top in recent years. But meanwhile, John, there's a new face at the top of the Democrats' fiscal deal makers, and that's Bernie Sanders. He's the Dems' new ranking member on the Senate Budget Committee, but he's not a Democrat. He's an independent and a self-described socialist, a label that he thinks matters less than it used to.
You don't need labels to say, should we raise the minimum wage to a living wage? Should the wealthy and large corporations pay their fair share of taxes? Can we create, or should we create, millions of jobs rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure? Should we deal with the issue of wealth and income inequality? I think on all of those issues, the American people, in a very loud voice, are saying yes, that the current system, in terms of the politics of our system, in terms of corporate control over the economy, that we need some significant changes.
But Sanders doesn't have any power in this debate.
Well, it's not that he doesn't have any power, but he has a lot less than Brady and Paul Ryan. He has some. Brady on the Ways and Means Committee is led by Paul Ryan, is going to be at the front of two big efforts, John, corporate tax reform and big trade deals. Now, Ryan has already written off any hope of a big deal that he would like with the president to curb Medicare and Social Security. But Brady, John, like Paul Ryan and Barack Obama, is a free trader. Big trade deal with Asian countries is in the works, and Brady likes that.
So we've got some exciting trade agreements, 21st century trade agreements, that would tear down those barriers, allow our companies to compete for those customers. You're going to create some real good-paying middle-class jobs, and that is an area of agreement between the White House and Republicans in the House and Senate.
But John, Bernie Sanders told me he's going to do everything he can, everything to stop those new trade deals. He's well to the president's left on this, and he's going to try to bring a lot of Democrats with him. Brady believes trade deals are big job creators. Sanders says, forget it.
Trade is clearly a policy decision. That's NAFTA, CAFTA, permanent normal trade relations with China. The evidence is pretty clear that those trade agreements have not only cost us millions of decent paying jobs, we have lost 60,000 factories since 2001, but has also pushed us in a race to the bottom, where many corporate executives are saying to their workers, look, if you don't take a cut in health care, you don't take a cut in wages, we're moving to China.
One thing that puzzles me about trade agreements is the administration and Republicans say that the U.S. economy is doing the best in the world, that Europe is stagnant and China's growth is way down. Trade agreements wouldn't necessarily seem to be the well to go to at this point.
They've gone back to that well every couple of years for more than 20 years since the Clinton era. It's a big commonality between free trading Democrats, and it's something that divides the Democratic Party. So what you're hearing there is Bernie Sanders from the left. He's going to give Obama a headache, and it depends on what Nancy Pelosi does. It's possible that Democrats don't go for these deals in the end, and they might get divided out of the debate. Can Sanders block it? That's one of the issues. And John, another big issue is, I know you're wondering, the minimum wage. It's a huge issue in Congress. And like most Republicans, Kevin Brady is against boosting the minimum wage. Now, he agrees that more than 70% of Americans are for it. So the question is, what don't they get?
You know, I think because most Americans have never run a small business, they don't understand just how harmful that raising a minimum wage, forcing a small business to pay $5,000 more a worker, but with no new sales and no new income, what happens is that they look to either lower the number of workers, cut their hours, or they quit hiring new people when they have the opportunity.
Now, John, Sanders says, as you might guess, boost the minimum wage, but he also wants $1 trillion in new infrastructure spending to put people back to work. He wants to kill trade deals, and he might be running for president. So the question is he just trying to nudge the Democratic Party to the populist left ahead of 2016?
I think the outrage, the political outrage of the moment, is the degree to which Congress has turned its back on working families. Go on out there. Ask people as to whether or not we should raise the minimum wage. Overwhelmingly, they say yes. My Republican colleagues say no. Ask people whether they think it's fair that people who make $25,000 a year are forced to work 50 or 60 hours a week without getting overtime. The American people say that's unfair.
In this debate, I don't hear a lot of compromise. I do hear a lot of positioning for 2016.
You hear a lot of positioning maybe for 2016, certainly a lot for the next 18 months, and some negotiations on trillions of dollars worth of taxes and trade, John.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, on the debate that will determine the budget battle going forward in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Todd.
You got it, John.
Here's an updated version of an old song. Betty and the Bobs singing a cover of the song from the Broadway musical Flower Drum Song. In today's installment of our series, Being a Woman Online, we go to an author, a TED talker, an entrepreneur, and a performer in a very different Broadway stage of today. Tavi Gevinson started blogging and creating the online magazine called Rookie when she was a preteen. She had a national following by the time she was in high school, a fresh 15-year-old who told the world there needed to be a community for young girls to talk freely, to support each other. She was right, in a big way. Rookie has become a sensation, a forum for feminism, sexuality, privacy, and identity, all free of the moralizing of the pre-internet age. The now 18-year-old editor-in-chief of Rookie has enough projects going that she's put off college and says she thinks the wave of empowerment she's riding still has a ways to go.
I'm going to generalize, but I think people of my generation, especially young women, are used to a kind of reductive sort of empowerment. And it's not like I think we should stop being like, you're beautiful, love yourself. But I guess at that age, when I was starting Rookie, I just wanted something that could be more nuanced and was looking for something where, you know, you could be honest about feeling bad about yourself or imperfect. And or maybe like being beautiful didn't have to matter because you could have other things that were more important to you and were and said more about who you are as a human being. Like I always, this is something I find myself saying a lot at like Rookie events or just when I'm talking to our readers is like, I always feel better about myself when I think of myself as a human before I think of myself as a woman, because there are expectations attached to being a girl or woman that when I remember I'm just a person really kind of fall away.
You know, it's funny because my daughters will say to me, you know, everyone's always telling us, you know, be sure to have self-esteem, be sure to have self-esteem, love yourself, yeah. Love yourself, you go, follow your dreams. And my daughters will say to me, what, why do they keep saying that? Is there something really right. awful that's going to happen right around the corner?
Right.
And it's almost like that's played out. We're done with that.
Well, I think for me, I became a lot more comfortable with myself and then eventually confident when I could just like accept that I don't always feel like a superhero or like Beyonce. Like I think if you can kind of make friends with that part of yourself instead of like feeling poorly about yourself and then also having the second layer of guilt for feeling poorly about yourself. I mean, I've talked to so many other women online about like feeling like shit and then being like, oh, and I'm a bad feminist for feeling this way. I just don't do well with the pressure to also like feel great about yourself. I would rather just kind of like make friends with a healthy dose of like self-criticism.
Well, that sounds good. Do you think sexuality is overplayed online, that there's just too much concern about it, that the notions of sexuality are maybe too much of a determinant of our identity, be they women or men?
What I look at on the internet is like 0.00001% of the internet. But I do think that a really great thing about, you know, sites I look at like Tumblr or Twitter and the communities I see there, the ones that I follow are largely like girls in high school who are very critical of the world around them. The good thing about it is that you realize more quickly how many alternatives there are to like the image of sexuality that you see on TV or in a magazine. And you realize that that's also not the real world and that there are a lot of other human beings who feel the way you do. Girls my age, well, no, girls for like generations, like since the beginning of time, you're taught that sex is like this incredibly, I don't know, like your body is a temple and your virginity is like this precious gift and it's supposed to be a huge deal. And I'm not saying that it isn't for a lot of women or just people, but I also think for a lot of people, it's really not. This is one thing I've definitely learned from editing Rookie and all the writing submissions we get and all the discussions that happen. It's like, yeah, for some girls, it is that like my body is a temple thing. And for some girls, that messes them up.
Do you think the women in your peer group have a really good radar for creeps online? I find adults are very, very concerned about predators and people who are searching the internet for victims.
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, really hard to speak to, like, female online population as a whole. But, yeah, I don't know. I think, I mean, one thing that's nice about people being creepy on the internet now is that there are a lot more communities and spaces where women can feel safe without it and feel like they don't have to deal with it.
And your Rookie is one of those places.
Yeah, I remember in our first – it's in our first book because we printed like 6 pages of the comments. We had a post that just came out of a bunch of our contributors talking in our Facebook group where one of them was like, I just had a horrible experience with street harassment. And then everyone's like, yeah, one time this happened to me. And then we just felt that those stories were very important and put them all together. And then the readers, I mean, every girl has a story like that. So then there were just all of these comments. I mean, to me, being exposed to that, seeing that it happens to other people, you can see all these stories and you're like, oh, no, they're the freaks. Like, they're disgusting. This is something that people do all the time and something that other women go through.
So are you going to carry Rookie as far as it'll go and then sell out to, you know, Rupert Murdoch or something like that?
Right. Look, I started when I was 15 because it was something that I needed. Rookie is very direct and very plainly exists to serve its readers. And I feel very understood by the girls who, like, come to our events and support us. So it holds a lot for me personally. I don't want to do anything that, you know, I don't want to be selfish. I don't want to be possessive. I also don't want to be irresponsible and put it in the hands of people I don't trust or anything. So I'm just trying to be as thoughtful as possible about what happens with Rookie next and not let it get too tied up in my own ego or possessiveness or like personal connection to it.
Well, good luck, Tavi.
Thank you.
Tavi Gevinson is the founder and editor-in-chief of Rookie. Our Being a Woman Online series continues with a Twitter chat this evening. We'll be joined by Jill Filipovich, creator of the website Feminista and political writer for Cosmopolitan.com. For more details, just visit thetakeaway.org. And from the debate over vaccination to the pursuit of new fertility techniques abroad, where is the line between politics and progress when it comes to science? comment from Washington. I fear the science is too valuable to stop and too dangerous to continue, but it is only dangerous if used improperly. How much trust do we put in each other?
Hi, this is Joan from Newton, Mass. Just because we have the ability to do something doesn't always mean that we should. We need to always think about what could be unintended consequences of our actions.
Share your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry. Or check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation. For increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, giftedandtalented.com, providing personalized online courses developed by Stanford University, designed to help K-12 students advance in mathematics, language arts, and beyond. More at giftedandtalented.com. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.